the port to resume normal activity. An Army Corps general said the announced timelines are ambitious and cautioned that there could be delays. President Biden is due to visit the bridge collapse site today. And the U.S. economy added another 303,000 jobs last month, far more than had been predicted by economists, suggesting continued economic resilience amid high interest rates and somewhat persistent inflation. The strong hiring data means a so-called soft landing, in which inflation is quelled without causing a recession, is still possible. The fresh Labor Department data showed the unemployment rate dropping 0.1% to 3.8%. Wage growth was moderate last month, with average hourly earnings up about 4% from a year ago, the smallest year-over-year increase in nearly 3 years. Federal Reserve policymakers are due to meet again at the end of this month. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 54 degrees and mostly cloudy. In New York City, 45 degrees and overcast. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
Bienvenidos a todo mi gente escuchando in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. In Central Colombia, here on this Friday, April 5th, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on historically black colleges and universities, or HBCUs, as Republican lawmakers extend their anti-CRT movement towards college institutions and how it might parallel the ethnic studies ban in Arizona back in the mid-2000s. Last March, lawmakers in Mississippi proposed a bill that would permanently close three historically black universities, Alcorn State, Jackson State, and Mississippi Valley State, respectively. Later in the month, the state GOP-controlled House in Tennessee voted to vacate the Board of Trustees in the state's only HBCU, Tennessee State University. Even in Florida, which was front and center in Republican hysteria over critical race theory last year, has raised concerns over the future of the state's only public HBCU, Florida A&M University. Collectively, these incidents may mark a new frontier in what can be called a Republican movement of anti-history. But this is neither new nor original. In fact, this latest iteration of anti-history looks similar to Republican attempts to ban ethnic studies in Arizona in the mid-2000s. The infamous SB 2281 bill that banned ethnic studies in Arizona also included the banning of books. Sound familiar? The similarities sound grim, but one important point about the battle for ethnic studies in Arizona is the grassroots organizations won their battle to a large degree. So what can HBCUs draw from the lessons and battles waged in Arizona over a decade and a half ago? Our guest today will give us some insight. So joining us once again on the show today is Professor Will Guzman. He's an Assistant Vice Chancellor of International Programs and Community Engagement at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina. It's been a while, but welcome back to the show, Professor Will Guzman.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And joining us for the first time is Nolan Cabrera. He's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Welcome to the show, Professor Nolan Cabrera.
Really appreciate you having me.
Absolutely. So this ought to be a very interesting discussion because the Latino Media Collective has been on WPFW since 2006, almost around the same time when the banning of ethnic studies in Arizona began to gain momentum. It's not that often that I toot my own horn here on the show, but I made the argument several years ago that the ambiguity of banning ethnic studies, if picked up by other states, would eventually call into question the existence of HBCUs. So I'm pretty sure you guys can point to various other flashpoints of anti-HBCU legislation, but perhaps the most infamous and recent was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis's assault on his state's AP African American Studies program right around this time last year. In fact, here's a clip from that famous speech from a year ago. Let's take a listen.
This course on Black history, what's one of the lessons about? Queer theory. Now, who would say that an important part of Black history is queer theory? That is somebody pushing an agenda on our kids. And so when you look to see they have stuff about intersectionality, abolishing prisons, that's a political agenda. And so that's the wrong side of the line for Florida standards. We believe in teaching kids facts and how to think, but we don't believe they should have an agenda imposed on them.
So that was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis and a clip of his infamous speech attacking AP African American Studies in Florida. So I want to get both of your opinions on this, but I'll start with Professor Guzman. Let's start with the million-dollar question here. Do you see the same parallels between recent attacks on Black studies and the ethnic studies ban in Arizona from almost a decade and a half ago?
Most certainly. This type of history, of course, goes back decades and even over a century. And so what we saw in Arizona in attacking Mexican-American studies and labeling it as anti-American, labeling it as Marxist, labeling it as anti-white, it really struck a chord or a nerve for many of the activists, Chicanas and Chicanos there in the state, to mobilize and organize and trying to fight back. Unfortunately, they were not successful to a certain degree. However, they did lay down the groundwork in terms of future fights. And so that mobilization we would see come to a head in terms of other issues that would galvanize many of the activists within the state. What we see in Florida, however, is a more sophisticated version of what went on in Arizona. But at the same time, it was more overt and more coarse. For example, in Florida, as you mentioned at the top of the program, you saw the governor explicitly go after African-American studies, very similar to Arizona. However, within the context of not fearful of the other in terms of immigrants, but fearful of African-Americans who obviously have been in the state well before even Florida even became a state in the 1820s, African Americans and people of African descent have been in Florida as early as the 1500s. And so you see that the governor refusing to acknowledge and appreciate that history instead chose to engage in fear mongering and in order to not only win votes, but win financial support and try to set the stage for a national run at the presidency. Obviously, he lost that fight, but he won in the sense that he was able to galvanize so much support. Even among moderates, if you will, you saw many people come out against this African-American AP course. And if you look at the details of that specific course, which ironically, I too was involved in helping for it to come to the fore, out of the over 100 chapters or sections within that class, only two or three really dealt with transgender issues or feminist issues, all these lightning rod issues that would, you know, fear or strike fear in many people, including conservative African Americans. And so it was very unfortunate. At the end of the day, we want our children, our teens, and even young adults, we want them to think critically. And those kinds of issues being incorporated into the class would help in that regard in terms of helping people critically think about who they are and what their place is in this society.
Well put. Professor Cabrera, your response. Politico did a retrospective back in 2021 on the banning of ethnic studies in the mid-2000s. And one of the things that they pointed out is that Republican lawmakers in Arizona around that time, you know, tried to use the term raza studies sort of in the same fear-mongering nature as the aforementioned Black queer studies that Ron DeSantis mentioned in Florida. So your response.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So it feels almost like I'm kind of in a like a racist version of that Bill Murray movie Groundhog Day, where, you know, you just see it keep repeating itself, because literally you can take the playbook that was drawn up in Arizona circa 2010 and take out Arizona, put in any other state that's doing this kind of work, and you have literally the same playbook. Because really what it requires, if we play the Wizard of Oz and pull the curtain back and show how the wizard is there actually manipulating things the whole time, there's a very set playbook. Step one, you need to find something that people don't understand. And so we've already heard little jargon coming around, raza studies, queer theory, all these different ones. You have to find something that's very, very, and you prey upon the ignorance of the masses. Then step two, you define what that is and you make it very, very harmful. It's like they banned Mexican American studies in Tucson. The first tenet of the bill, it said explicitly, you are not allowed to have classes that promote the overthrow of the U.S. government. Okay. Now, since the country has been founded, sedition is illegal. Like that's not, so that's an unnecessary component of the bill, but it's not a legal issue. It's a discursive issue. It's trying to say Mexican American studies, raza studies is subversive, white hating, American hating, Marxist, all these things, because the kissing cousin of ignorance is fear. And that's what they're trying to play off of. So then there's this willful misdefinition. And then what you do is then you attack. You attack and you say this horrible white-hating, man-hating, American-hating thing, I am the one who can save you from it. And then it wins you political votes frequently. And it's funny because raza studies, that became a lightning rod in there because it was this most simplistic argumentation. It'd say, raza studies. Well, you'd hear the lawmakers say, well, raza means the race, and it's therefore racist. And I always tell my students, if you want to willfully misunderstand something, you use its absolute literal definition in no context. You know, language only means things in context. Like if I said, hey, Oscar, what's up? You're not going to actually look up that literally. It doesn't work like that, right? You know, I'm saying hi. Or if I said, what's up, Holmes? I'm not calling you a house. There are ways that these terms have meaning in context. And the problem is that these folks just don't have a basic grasp of the nature of language. Or maybe they actually have a basic concept of the nature of language and they use it for horrible means to attack, demean, dehumanize. Because again, you can't be Superman unless you have your Lex Luthor. and they have to create their Lex Luthor in order to be seen as the Superman. And unfortunately, while it is basically a distraction from the fact that they don't have any real legislative agenda, at the end of the day, it still has very negative material effects on our communities in the process. Because as we all know, it takes so much more energy to build something up than it does to tear something down.
Well put. I want to get to the issue of the banning of books. But before we do that, I want to support your point here with regards to the issue of misunderstanding a community or a history, because the LA Times, as recently as this past February, did a fantastic article on how ethnic studies are actually being expanded in California. Mm-hmm. And they did like cite one critic or something to the extent of a critic. And I'll actually read the quote here. And again, this is from the LA Times earlier this year that, quote, some critics have urged the University of California, which is the university expanding ethnic studies in question here, some critics have urged UC to reject any ethnic studies admission requirement, in part because they fear how Israel would be discussed in some courses, particularly if critiques of colonialism and imperialism against marginalized communities include the plight of Palestinians. This is a very fascinating article, and I was going to mention it to you guys later, but it's fascinating because they weren't talking about African-American studies. They weren't talking about Chicano or Latino studies. They were talking about Asian-American studies being expanded and how the history of colonialism and imperialism in that part of the world would lead to sympathy towards Palestinians. But I digress. So again, one crucial component to the banning of ethnic studies is the banning of books. In fact, people will be surprised to find out that the books of acclaimed African-American writer James Baldwin was banned in both Arizona and recently in Florida. Other books banned in Arizona at the time included works by Juno Diaz, Sandra Cisneros, even The Tempest by William Shakespeare. But such bans are not exclusive to Florida and Arizona. We could talk about Texas later on during the course of the show here. What do you make, Professor Gavreda, of this component of banning ethnic studies as it pertains to the scholars and writers whose work have been banned?
So I'm going to take it in two different directions. The first is that I find it wholly ironic that the same people who most overtly profess, you know, freedom, freedom, freedom. I mean, the right of the right wing in Congress is called the Freedom Caucus, right? And there is nothing more antithetical to freedom than the restriction of ideas. And it doesn't matter how abhorrent you find these ideas, that's censorship at its core. I teach Rush Limbaugh in some of my classes, not because I agree with them, but because it's important to understand a variety of viewpoints. And these kind of restrictions and this banning, it's antithetical to everything that America is allegedly supposed to stand for. And I think what's really insidious about it is that when I get a lot of media interviews around this issue, the focus is maybe these things are a little controversial. And there was this one girl who learned about critical race theory and said, I reject it because I don't want to hate my white parents. And it's like, okay, all of that may be true. I'll accept your premise on its front, but you don't go and ban something in the process. That's antithetical to what we're supposed to be as a country if we're going to have a free flow of ideas. Now, in terms of people whose books have been banned, I want to reframe that slightly, because when you get your book on a banned book list, it may hurt you locally in terms of circulation in, say, Arizona, but it actually ups your profile nationally. Like, oh, here's a, you know, exactly. It was kind of like back in the day when they had the little tipper stickers, the parental advisory stickers on your CDs, and you'd be like, oh, I want to listen to that one. The insidious effect, though, is the removal of that knowledge from the children, from the students. I'm going to nerd out for a quick second. You had Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed removed when it was here in Arizona, right? When I lecture throughout the country, for those of you who aren't, you know, educational nerds like me, Pedagogy of the Oppressed is really, really hard to get through. I mean, it's really difficult. It's taught in a lot of graduate schools of education throughout the country, and folks are still like, yeah, I was 27 and it was still tough for me. You had 17 and 18 year old kids reading that. And not only reading it, but understanding it and applying it to their everyday lives. That's an educational accomplishment to be celebrated. And to remove the ability to do that is, I mean, it borders on what I would almost say is educational malpractice, because you're not allowing students to get the necessary information that can actually positively affect their lives. You're not allowing them to be critical thinkers because you're making these choices for them. And if we really want to get to the insidious nature of this, you know, if we're really trying to protect kids from horrible things like genocide and rape and incest, the first book that's going to get banned is the Bible. But we know that's not happening. And it shows the political undercurrents that it's not based upon any principle. This is based upon political expediency.
So, Professor Guzman, before you respond, I just want to point out some other books that were banned in Florida that are worth mentioning. And that includes Beloved by Toni Morrison, The 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones. There's a book called Black Birds in the Sky by Brady Colbert, which is based on the Tulsa Race Massacre of 1921, and also Bell Hooks, among many others. So your response.
Sure. I can't help but to agree more with Nolan. And that example he gives regarding the Bible, at the core of this is how do we preserve and maintain white supremacy? And Christianity is closely linked to European culture. You can't mention the word Christianity without mentioning whiteness because they're synonymous and they've been synonymous for hundreds, if not thousands of years. And so despite the Bible having those very controversial issues and topics being raised, it will never be banned because at the core of this project of banning books is really an attack on the browning of America. As you see the increase of African-Americans, the increase of African immigrants, the increase of many Latinas and Latinos coming into the nation from the South, and of course, the high birth rates of many of those groups within the country. What's happening is, as many of us already know, as the white population becomes more and more educated, they have less and less children. And so what the lawmakers are attempting to do is their last gasp or their last stance, if you will, in that they're thinking, how do we maintain and preserve white supremacy, domination, and control? One way in doing that, of course, is through preserving language. Thus, you have these English-only laws and legislations being passed. But another way of doing that, of course, is by banning the intellectual class, the intellectuals who are critiquing the nation, not because they're against the nation, but in fact, it's an act of love in terms of bettering the nation for everyone involved. How do we get all these groups participating in the American ideal or in the American dream? Studies, statistics, and data, the numbers don't lie, as the cliche goes. And many Black and brown folks are not part of the American dream. As Brother Malcolm used to say, we are the American nightmare. We're last in every major quality of life indicator, from wealth, from income, from even health indicators, and so on. Black and brown folks are suffering. And what these lawmakers who are creating these bans on these books, they don't want to address that issue because, of course, they think that it's a zero-sum game. That if they create legislation that will actually benefit Black and brown folks, that means white folks are losing out on something. And in fact, study after study actually confirms the opposite, that when you create legislation that directly benefits Black and brown folks, white folks are usually disproportionately the number one beneficiaries of that type of legislation. But nevertheless, in terms of the banning of those particular authors, here again, at its core, is them challenging the status quo and reflecting a more accurate history, but also appealing to young people, including progressive whites, appealing to young people and letting them know very optimistically and hopefully that a better society could be had if they embrace this new knowledge.
Because after all, what is ethnic studies but another form of the pursuit of knowledge, especially when it's done correctly? And it's quite clear, talking with you guys right now, that GOP lawmakers are clearly not talking to academics when they make these decisions in the first place. So, Professor Cabrera, In 2016, you were invited by the Ethnic Studies Now Coalition to speak to the LAUSD Board of Education's Curriculum, Instruction, and Educational Equity Committee meeting. In your presentation, you quoted the late historian George Takaki on the importance of ethnic studies, especially as a statement of intent against the prevailing winds of xenophobia. In fact, I have a clip here from this presentation, so let's take a listen.
Going back to the core of why ethnic studies in the first place, and the Berkeley ethnic studies professor Ronald Takaki gave a brilliant synopsis of why ethnic studies in the introduction to his book, A Different Mirror, where he said, what happens, to borrow from the words of Adrian Rich, when someone with the authority of a teacher describes our society and you are not in it? Such an experience can be disorienting, a moment of psychic disequilibrium, like as if you looked into a mirror and saw nothing. And the idea behind ethnic studies is to provide different mirrors for our students so that they can actually see themselves in it. And in particular, in the Tucson context, because we have a very xenophobic context, it's not just seeing yourself, but seeing a positive image of yourself in that context, because we have actually some very strong portrayals. They just have very strong negative portrayals of students.
So, Professor Cabrera, if you could expand on George Takaki's statement and how it still holds meaning even today, because it's sort of a component of this whole ethnic studies battle that isn't mentioned as often as it should. The fact that students don't see themselves in history books as often as they should.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And oh gosh, I hate listening to my own voice. That's just cringe. But, and really quickly, his name's Ronald Takaki, not George.
Ronald,
but regardless, sorry. But I always love the pursuit of knowledge for knowledge's sake, but that's because I'm a giant nerd. I read educational philosophy for fun. I am not a normal type person. Most of the time, people like having things that are directly relevant to their everyday lives. And unfortunately, when students are taught, I don't know, Tippecanoe and Tyler too is almost a form of trivia, that it's like, well, how does that mirror my life? How does that mirror my existence? What's the relevance of that? Because again, you can get kids to memorize things, but you get them engaged if you say, if you learn this, you can actually improve your community. You can improve your life. You can go about doing this in meaningful and uplifting ways. And it's a situation that requires education to really do a lot of different things. Number one is to, and this is really difficult for a lot of teachers to engage with meaningfully, it decenters the authority of the teacher and really tries to look at the students as the experts of their community. And it's not saying that they're going to necessarily know, whatever statistics are available, but they know in their lived experience that this is a hot corner or there's this tension here, or they are experts in the community. You have to defer a lot of that expertise to them and have a co-constructed idea of what education should be. Also, it tries to blur the lines between the community and education, because all too often, whether it's in higher education or even in K-12, there's sort of like there's school and then there's the community. There's higher education, the ivory tower, and then there's the community. And this actually tries to blur those lines. And that was part of the demands out of the 1960s that created ethnic studies in the first place. And what makes people really, really uncomfortable, though, and if we're being honest about where ethnic studies comes from, in order to create these different mirrors, it's rooted very much in a struggle. It goes back to the Frederick Douglass notion of that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never has and it never will. Well, this is a curricular demand on systems of white power to change and to challenge the system to actually have our students embedded in these spaces. But unfortunately, that legacy of struggle makes people very uncomfortable. We were talking earlier about the moderates who can be very complacent and forget that it was the legacy of struggle that allowed us to be comfortable contemporarily. And it's funny because, ironically, these ideas of rebellion go back to the war for independence in the United States, but we forget how socially disruptive that was. We just say, oh yeah, Britain was bad, we were good, we fought them, and that's that. And it's easy to do that externally. It's a lot more difficult to say, oh wait, white supremacy was bad, people of color rose up, because that's internal. It implicates a lot of us in the process. But without that struggle, we don't have ethnic studies, but it's remembering and honoring that and saying that we are living out that legacy to provide a better material future for the next generation, that the sort of the core of ethnic studies is manifest. But in many respects, it requires us to do education in a very, very substantially different way this kind of false binary. We either, and you hear this a lot right now around the DEI debates, where it's like, it's either DEI or rigorous academic work. It's like, no, our students only need to be known their ABCs and 1, 2, 3s. And the argument of ethnic studies is actually, if the students see themselves meaningfully in the curriculum, it actually provides a stronger motivation to do well on their ABCs and 1, 2, 3s. And in that respect, this whole idea of DEI and standard education being antithetical or harmful to each other is false. It's that actually one builds off of the other, and they should exist in this way.
So right now, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson, and Professor Will Guzman, who's an assistant vice chancellor of international programs and community engagement at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina. This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned. Was Los Guadawao, and you're listening to the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone that you could also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show, and of course live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we're speaking about Republican attacks on HBCUs and the parallels between what we've seen recently with the banning of ethnic studies in Arizona back in the mid-2000s. And we're joined by Professor Will Guzman, who's an assistant vice chancellor of international programs and community engagement at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina, and Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson. So censoring ethnic studies is one thing. Seeing the perverse whitewashing of history afterwards may be even worse. The most shocking example was the results of Ron DeSantis' school curriculum overhaul late last year, in which the Florida Board of Education approved a new set of rules requiring teachers to tell students, among other things, that there were upsides to being enslaved. The Guardian compared DeSantis to the whitewashing of the Civil War by the United Daughters of the Confederacy over a century ago. And to make matters even worse, DeSantis approved the use of content by the conservative organization PragerU to further propagate such whitewashing. Professor Guzman, where do we fit this whitewashing that we saw in Florida late last year with recent assaults on HBCUs? I mean, I'm pretty sure that you were just as much as appalled as any other academic late last year with what came out of DeSantis's overhaul of the education system in Florida.
Indeed. One of the outgrowths of those attacks in terms of CRT, DEI, the AP Black History class, and other initiatives, one of those was the entire board at New College in Florida, where New College was viewed as this institution that had too many progressives, too many liberals. And so under the guise of low enrollment and low performance, he went in there and appointed not only a very conservative president, but a very conservative entire board of trustees. And so we see very similar initiatives throughout the entire South, quite frankly, where many state legislators are creating these metrics that all universities have to meet. But the bar is so high that you see many smaller schools, many MSIs or minority serving institutions, tribal colleges, and even, of course, HBCUs, that it's what I call death by a thousand cuts, that if you're not meeting certain metrics, graduation rates, retention rates, recruitment, then the state will deny you funding. And so over time, you will become cash strapped and be forced to shut down. And so how that falls under this attack on CRT and DEI is similar to really not wanting to see Black folks succeed by going to college and graduating and becoming successful in the mainstream world, despite, of course, having these attacks on the community. And so for many HBCUs, they serve as major anchors and pillars of the African-American community and are a vital resource. Many are open access. And of course, the history of HBCUs lends itself to never having been discriminatory from its outset. And so many whites and other people of color, including Native Americans and Latinos, Latinas, and others, have historically attended HBCUs for many, many decades. But yet, for these lawmakers, they feel that they have to create legislation to ensure that HBCUs no longer succeed because of that symbolism of success. They've done more with less. Most recently, about 2 years ago, Forbes magazine wrote an excellent article on how most HBCUs that are public and land grant, having been denied funding by state legislators, despite federal law, specifically the 1890 Morrell Act, requiring that the funding of HBCUs be equivalent and on par as PWIs or predominantly white institutions. And so what Forbes did was they looked at just the past 30 years. It didn't even go back to the 1800s when many of these HBCUs were established. They went back just the last 30 years from 1980 to the present. And they found billions upon billions of dollars being denied to institutions such as my own alma mater, Florida A&M University, including Tennessee State University, $1.9 billion, as well as, of course, right here in the state of North Carolina, North Carolina A&T University, of well over $2.2 billion. And so what you see, of course, is these institutions doing more with less and being forced to the rigors and regulations of lawmakers. But even with all that, they're still being attacked by both the mainstream community in terms of white supremacists planting bombs and targeting HBCU students for threats and violence, but also by the political class in terms of shrinking dollars.
And you're right to point out that a lot of what we're discussing here as far as banning ethnic studies and attacks on HBCUs, a lot of it is happening in the Southeast and in the Southwest of the country. And the lack of funding for HBCUs sort of segues our attention to Texas and Governor Greg Abbott. So in March of last year, if you recall, the governor's office announced that the state was taking over the public school district in Houston, one of the largest in the country. Later in the summer of last year, Governor Abbott also signed a bill that bans diversity, equity, and inclusion DEI offices at public colleges and universities across the state. The Texas Legislative Black Caucus, much like what we have been doing during the course of this conversation, recognized the ambiguity of this proposal as a threat to ethnic studies and the state's HBCUs. Around the same time, the independence of Texas Southern University came into question as a result. So, Professor Guzman, since you wrote a book entitled Civil Rights in the Texas Borderlands, can you give your perspective on recent events in Texas that deserve equal attention to what we've seen in Florida and in Arizona?
Sure. In fact, I also taught at Peer Review A&M University years ago. And at the time when I worked there, Ruth Simmons was president of that illustrious institution, one of the most, if not the most prominent HBCU within the state of Texas. And even she was forced to step down because of these politics by the governor and other lawmakers within the state. This president, President Ruth Simmons, just had an illustrious career for many decades, having been president at Brown University, at Smith College, and then Prairie View. And it was just unfortunate to see her step down. But politics played a hand in that she had created a institute to look at the issue of race just days after the murder of George Floyd. And many lawmakers, of course, took umbrage to that. And they were hell-bent in ensuring that that institute would not come to fruition. But she, because of her political contacts as well as her corporate contacts, she was able to raise private money to ensure that the institute would come to fruition. And so that, of course, the die was set and her days were numbered, and she ultimately stepped down just about a year and a half ago. But to answer your question more directly, many of these policies, of course, are playing to the base. And the base, of course, is this hardcore right-wing constituency that is only voting for these very right-wing politicians, such as a Greg Abbott. And at the core of this is really, how do we defund public education? How do we get the state government out of the business of running educational institutions? For many of these lawmakers, particularly those on the right, they don't want to commit public dollars to major public institutions. They see the role of government is strictly to protect the society, for law enforcement, for the National Guard, for Border Patrol, and nothing else. And ultimately, over the next 10 to 20 years, you'll see this argument come to the fore much obviously. And you'll see it over the last 30 to 40 years, for example, in terms of state allocation dollars on a per pupil basis has become less and less. Right now, it stands at just barely over 30 to 40%. When in years past, it was well over 80% or more where the state would allocate towards higher education or to particular universities. And so these attacks that Greg Abbott has signed into legislation, getting rid of DEI at the University of Texas at Austin, at all public universities throughout the state, for example, serves that role in frustrating the students at those institutions, frustrating those students that whereby DEI appeals to them, but also it appeals to those whites in particular, but the conservatives in general that really don't want to engage in what they think is political correctness in terms of addressing the needs of so many of our students, both Black and Brown students, but even white students who may be experiencing questioning of their sexual orientation, who may be experiencing discrimination on campus based on their religion or based on their sex. And so for these DEI offices to be eliminated, it signals to those individuals that they have a voice in terms of their conservative worldview and their resistance to embracing the other with a capital O.
Yeah, in Texas in particular, it's particularly sad, especially when I think in the back of my mind the tragedy that took place in Uvalde almost 2 years ago, because that could have been an opportunity to point out the rich Chicano social justice history that that community had. But now it's been overshadowed by the tragedy. But that could have been a good opportunity to talk about that little town's rich history. But the opportunity was lost, unfortunately. So we have about 10 minutes left. We've spoken a lot about the politics of ethnic studies being banned and how HBCUs are under attack, sort of in the same similar fashion, if not with the same rhetoric. But I want to end this with the both of you to talk about the beauty and the importance and the enlightenment of ethnic studies. So Professor Cabrera, last year on a different program, I had the pleasure of speaking with Sean Arce, who was a co-founder and former director of the Mexican American Studies Department in the Tucson Unified School District. He was infamously fired from his position in 2012, almost around the same month that he won a National Teaching Award. And in our conversation last year, he pointed out that the benefits of ethnic studies extended beyond the typical student-teacher dynamic, but also engaging parents into looking into the literature they themselves never saw when they went for school. So I want to know if you could elaborate on the benefits of ethnic studies, not just for students, but for parents as well, because this is a nuance of ethnic studies that even proponents often overlook. And I would point this out specifically because I'm the son of Salvadoran immigrants. And growing up in Washington, when it was still a majority African-American city, one of the required readings I had when I went through the school system was the biography of Malcolm X. They didn't know who he was. As immigrants, they were not privy to that part of American history. So could you elaborate on the benefits of ethnic studies for parents, especially those that might be new to the country?
Absolutely. Just as a point of context, I had kind of this moment of aha as we're having this conversation. Isn't it amazing how ethnic studies and that the crisis just occurs, it just happens to occur during an election year? Isn't it amazing coincidentally that, you know, and I bring that up because I'm thinking back and I'd forgotten, but when the ban on ethnic studies and Mexican-American studies in particular in Tucson happened, that was one of the core midterm election year issues, you know, and we've seen that happen quite a bit. I mean, H.R. 4437, which is the massive anti-immigrant piece back in 2006, again, it happened right in a midterm election year. And so if anything shows how manufactured the crisis is, that it's that. But getting back to your question, I still want to start with the students, but then I'll get to the parents, that I had the distinct pleasure with the Mexican-American Studies program and controversy in Tucson. I was the stats guy. I ran the numbers on it. And it was one of these ones where, and that became a foundational component, a foundational piece of evidence in the subsequent trial that overturned the state law that was used to ban Mexican-American studies. And it showed consistently that students, after taking just one, two was the real sweet point, the real important sweet point for it. But after taking the Mexican-American studies classes, they succeeded at some of the highest levels of anyone in the district. Before taking the Mexican-American studies classes, they averaged something like a 2.1 grade point average. And that kind of growth in educational scholarship is absolutely unheard of. And actually, when we were presenting that in the case, the person to rebut me, just he couldn't rebut methodologically. He was saying, basically, the numbers are too good to be believed. And all of a sudden, we have like a back to stand and deliver like moment. It's like, you know, my kids should be rewarded, not hurt for this. But with all of that said, and keep in mind that one of the big findings that people that kind of flew under the radar by taking Mexican-American studies and controlling these ridiculously complicated statistical models, that they were even more likely to pass standardized tests in math, even though there's no Chicano studies math class, which starts to indicate that it's not just about the ones and zeros and the ABCs, but that it's changing their relationship to school and the community. And you see that manifest in some very important ways. And what ends up happening is you have students who are energized, who are engaged, and who don't just take what they are presented as at face value. They say, okay, you know what? Things are this way right now, but they don't always have to be this way. And it opens up what C. Wright Mills used to call the sociological imagination. You can start seeing the potential of what society could be. And so the first thing, the way that it really benefits parents, first of all, is that you're not worried about your kid dropping out. You're more worried about how much they keep talking about this stuff that you don't quite understand, but they're engaged in it they're reading books and they're engaged in their communities.
Exactly.
And the shifting concern changes. And that, especially in a barrio school district, is so critically important. I mean, we had in Tucson, I talk about, you know, students who would come and testify at school board meetings and engage in, you know, in forms of protest and resistance. And one of my friends in California was talking, I was like, I can't get my kids to come to class on a regular basis. These students are so engaged in their education that they're willing to go to school board meetings. And I don't know if you've been to a school board meeting, but they are boring. They're really, really boring. I mean, it's important business, but they're not exactly the most dynamic thing in the world. And so you have these students who are out there doing this. And at the end of the day, that's really what it's all about, is this engaged populace. And what ends up happening is then they also find motivation to do this because they have younger brothers and sisters who are coming up to the pipeline. And they saw how much they struggled before taking these classes. And they want to make sure there's like a commitment to improving society. And that includes not just for their families in particular, but for the larger Tucson community as a whole. That's a beautiful thing. And then, like you said, that then, especially because a lot of these curricula are based upon students using their communities as research laboratories, that it challenges their parents to think differently about the communities in the process. And it engages and it infuses a lot of energy into the community as a process, because it's easy for us to sit there and say, okay, well, been down this road before, and here's sort of, we have, you know, option A or option B, we have Coke or Pepsi. And the students are like, well, why don't you think about option C? What about option D? And that's a beautiful thing about this kind of education, because all too often you hear about imagination as, oh, that's just daydreaming and it's, you know, this kind of fluffy hippie stuff. Without imagination, we are confined to what we see in our everyday existence. And yet, without the slightest bit of irony, the people who demean that kind of education will then quote Dr. King's I Have a Dream, and not realizing, no, he had to engage in that bold visioning of what could be, despite all of the available evidence saying, absolutely not, we've been structured in this way for so long, it's going to continue to be that way. It takes the boldness, the courage, and the imagination to do that. That's a crux of what ethnic studies offered when done correctly.
Professor Guzman, we have about 2 minutes left. Can you tell us about how ethnic studies extend beyond the classroom, extend beyond the student-teacher dynamic here?
Well, certainly. Just to co-sign and add to what Dr. Cabrera has already indicated, is what Black studies, what ethnic studies, what CRT, and so many other so-called radical curriculum does is mobilization and organization. And in addition to that, racial consciousness, as well as public engagement, and both on a political level, but community uplift. So you have that political engagement and community uplift. And this, you would think, this is what lawmakers should want, is a educated public that is engaged. But in fact, they don't want that. And that's kind of the other little dirty secret in all this, is that not only are they fearful of the browning of America, but they are also fearful of an educated class. Now, one could argue against that and say, well, in certain states and overall in the nation, you see a college educated populace of anywhere between 25 to, in certain communities, as high as 40%. Well, I would still argue that for many of those, although they are college educated, doesn't necessarily mean that they are racially conscious, that they are politically engaged, and that they are involved in the community, particularly in community uplift. You know, most people, because of a variety of reasons, are not doing that. And so for CRT and Black studies and ethnic studies, you know, as Dr. Cabrera has indicated, these students are highly motivated, highly engaged, and they're challenging the status quo. And that, of course, is going to be disruptive, and they don't want a citizenry that is disruptive. They want someone that's mentally and psychologically asleep and embracing Western values, which are antithetical to the core values of most Black and Brown folks.
Strong words from two fantastic guests, and it's quite clear that we've only hit the tip of the iceberg of this debate as it continues to develop. But in the meantime, we've been speaking with Professor Will Guzman, who's an assistant vice chancellor of international programs and community engagement at North Carolina Central University in Durham, North Carolina. Professor Will Guzman, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you for having me.
And we've also been speaking with Nolan Cabrera, who's a professor of educational policy studies and practice at the University of Arizona in Tucson. Thank you for being on the show, Professor Nolan Cabrera.
It was a wonderful conversation. Really appreciate the invite.
You got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW must move by December 2024 and will be hosting a series of events and presenting special programming to raise the funds necessary for our new home. We kick off these efforts Saturday through Sunday, April 6th and 7th, with Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, 2 days of programming dedicated to the jazz and funk idioms. From the searing riffs of the J.B. Horns to Les McCann's soulful piano comping, to the Art Ensemble of Chicago's funk-drenched composition themed to Yo-Yo, jazz and funk have always been intertwined. We're hoping that the music inspires you to support this effort by visiting WPFWFM.org to make a tax-deductible secure donation to our relocation fund. That's Jazz is the Teacher, Funk is the Preacher, Saturday and Sunday, April 6th and 7th, from midnight to midnight. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns with some brief news headlines. The Israeli military said today that it fired 2 officers and reprimanded 3 others for their roles in a strike that killed 7 humanitarian workers earlier this week. The military said those officers mishandled information and violated rules of engagement. A retired Israeli general prepared a report on the killing, the results of which were released late yesterday. The speed of the investigation and the quick decision to punish officers is highly unusual for Israel, which often takes ample time to probe alleged military crimes and typically does not reveal what, if any, response is taken. An Israeli military spokesperson promised that such a strike, quote, won't happen again. Israeli forces have killed thousands of innocent people, including children, in Gaza. The UN estimates about 200 humanitarian aid workers have been killed. President Biden spoke by phone with Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu yesterday and told him future U.S. support for the war in Gaza depends on whether Israel increases protections for civilians and aid workers. The White House said in a statement following the call that Biden, quote, made clear that U.S. policy with respect to Gaza will be determined by our assessment of Israel's immediate action on these steps, end quote. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken reiterated the president's perspective at a press conference in Belgium this morning.
It's also critical that we see an independent, thorough, and fully publicized investigation into the killing of the World Central Kitchen team who were performing heroic work under the most difficult circumstances in trying to get assistance to people who so desperately need it.
In their phone call, Biden also reportedly urged Netanyahu to reach a deal for a ceasefire, quote, without delay. The White House statement made no mention of the widely reported impending sale of F-15 fighter jets to Israel, worth about $18 billion. In domestic news, Facebook parent company Meta said today that it will expand how it labels content created by artificial intelligence amid election-related concerns over deepfakes and other misleading content. The company said it will insert made with AI labels to videos, audio, and images created by AI. Previous Meta policy only applied to videos. The expanded policy came after Meta's oversight board called the prior policy incoherent and urged the company to address AI-created audio. Army engineers working to clear debris from the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge said yesterday that they expect to restore navigation to and from the Port of Baltimore by the end of this month. The planned limited access channel would be about 35 feet deep and 280 feet wide, large enough to support one-way traffic for some vessels carrying automobiles and farm equipment. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers said a permanent 700-foot wide and 50-foot deep channel would be reopened by the end of May, allowing the port to resume normal activity.